As the world's first IMBA Gold Level Ride Center since 2012, Park City, Utah is a premier mountain biking destination. What makes Park City a Gold Level Ride Center? For starters, the immediate area boasts a diverse variety of trails spread across 450 miles, with everything from paved commuting paths for a family-friendly ride to aggressive cross-country rides like the epic Wasatch Crest Trail. Combined with magnificent scenery, numerous bars and restaurants, world-class accommodations, free public transit, and a wide range of entertainment options, it's no wonder that Park City was awarded gold. Experiencing Park City, Utah has never been easier, and there's never been a better time than now. Arrange your stay, rent a bike, and book a guide by visiting mountainbikingparkcity.com. Hey everybody, welcome to the Single Tracks Podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Ken Avery. So Ken is the Vice President of Product and Marketing for Vittoria, the world's leading producer of bicycle tires. As an industry insider for many years, Ken has a wealth of knowledge on everything from mountain bike product design to marketing. Thanks for joining us, Ken.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm a big fan of your podcast and your website. I've been following it for a very long time, and so it's a great honor to be here, actually.
Yeah, that's right. We were talking a couple of years ago about how Singletrack started out as Mud Honey was the name of the site. And you're like, is that the same site?
Yeah, absolutely. I used to sit in college at UMass Amherst and just like troll the internet for mountain bike websites when there were very, very few. And that was one of the first. So I thought it was really cool that it was all connected, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So how did you get your start in the bike industry?
You know, I grew up skateboarding and I always kind of liked like individual sports and things like that. And you know, I mean, I played regular sports too, but it was the kind of thing where I always was drawn to that type of a thing where, you know, there weren't rules. You could kind of do it however you wanted kind of a self-expression thing. A buddy of mine who I used to skate with, he grew really tall, really fast when we were kids and his knees were really weak and his doctor told him to ride a bike. Hmm. And that was right around when mountain biking was kind of starting to pop, like in the early, so it was like literally like 1990 when this happened. And so I'm 42 years old, but you know, I still act like I'm 20, I guess. But anyway, he got a mountain bike, this new mountain bike thing. And I was like, well, that's pretty cool. You can cover a lot of ground on that thing, you know? And we lived in kind of suburban Eastern Connecticut, almost by Rhode Island, kind of. Mm-hmm. There were just like a ton of like fire roads everywhere and trails and stuff. And so I used to ride like an old Schwinn 10 speed around and explore these trails. And then finally saved up and ended up getting a mountain bike. And then I was totally hooked and grew up kind of racing through my teens. Mm. Did okay. The super short version is I bumped into Kathy Sessler, who actually runs the Syndicate team now. Uh-huh. And she was at the Mount Snow World Cup. Mount Snow, Vermont was sort of like our East Coast big mountain bike race at the time. And so, yeah, like I got a flat tire during practice. She gave me an inner tube. I was like totally starstruck that like a pro would give some kid an inner tube. And I mean, literally like was so floored and went out to a bike shop, bought an inner tube, came back after the race and gave it to her. And she thought that was funny because she was like a pro who rides for a tire company. And anyway, we just kind of like kept in contact and I would send her drawings like from study hall of like tires that I was thinking about. Literally when I was in high school. And she would fax them. Fax machines were a thing because it was the 90s. And she would fax them to, you know, Maxxis. Maxxis was Changshin Tire. And Maxxis had been making bike tires for a couple years at this point, but they were still very, very new. And then they started sending me tires to test. And by that point, I had gotten a UCI license and had gotten an upgrade and all that stuff and was doing okay racing. And then just kept on giving them feedback. And when I got out of college, Russell Webb at the time was their marketing guy and kind of running the bike division. And he gave me a job like right out of college. And we started designing tires with all the athletes.
Wow. That's super cool. Sounds like you were a hustler from an early age.
You know what it is, man? I think what it comes down to is that I just love bikes and I love like the scene and just kind of like, I'm always so grateful to still be a part of it. And it all started with an inner tube. I mean, I could have just been like, oh, thanks for the tube. See you later. You know what I mean? But for whatever reason, I was so psyched that I was still able to ride that day. And it kind of like I mean, not to sound weird or whatever, but it kind of like changed my life from that moment in a way, you know what I mean? So that was kind of my deal.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the cooler stories I've heard about how somebody has gotten into the industry.
Thanks, man.
So you've been around a while. I mean, not as long as some other folks, but how has mountain bike tire design and technology evolved over the years?
Man, this is that could be a podcast in and of itself, I feel like. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, it used to be that, I mean, first of all, tubeless. I mean, just to start with that, right? I mean,
right.
But everything used to have an inner tube, and a lot of things were wire bead, and compounds were nowhere near what they are now. Mm. And, you know, everything was like, you know, your like 70 or 80 durometer kind of compound. And rim brakes, you know, were the thing. So you had a kind of design around all those kind of parameters, and people didn't really know what really worked on a mountain bike tire, because it was kind of like the Wild West at the time. And a lot, you look at a tire like, say, the Panaracer Smoke, which was like the first, I think it was like the first real like aggressive mountain bike tire where you looked at that and you said, that thing's badass, and mm-hmm. you know, and whatever. And even that, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense on the front, you know, because it's a big paddle. So it's funny. Things have really gotten very specific per category, as well as just with materials. So, you know, obviously folding beads came in, sidewall protection came in, tubeless ready came in, compounds, really directional treads. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to almost look like it was like the sole of a hiking boot or something. You know, you look at,
yeah.
you look at like a specialized ground control from like the 80s, 90s, early 90s kind of era. And it kind of almost looks like a hiking boot or something, you know, in a way. It doesn't scream like, oh, that's going to roll fast and hook up. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it was, and the reason I mentioned that, I don't say that to speak poorly of that tire. What the reason I mentioned that was because that thing was the bomb back then. that was like the one of the better tires on the market. And mm-hmm. and looking at it now, you're like, oh wow, it looks so simple. So yeah, I mean, a lot has evolved. A lot's come from motorsport, and then just kind of over time, what has worked and what hasn't. You know, so you learn along the way.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, I mean, you kind of hint at it too, that the bikes have evolved, and so that's kind of made the tires evolve with it. I mean, taking brakes, for example, like now you have way more stopping power. And so the tire is going to need to react differently to that than, you know, it would have in the rim brake days, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the sheer power that you have from a disc brake now, but also your riding is different, right? So like you brake later because you can rely on that power of a disc brake. So that puts like an awful lot of stress on that tire in a really short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then you're also in a time period where we're trying to use softer compounds. So how do you make that grippier, softer tire last longer? And
yeah.
these are the kind of conundrums that you try to solve and design around as a product guy in the bike biz these days.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Obviously a lot of different competing factors and things that you're trying to optimize for. So I want to ask you, what's going on with tire widths right now? Seems like that's the question every year, but you know, obviously a lot of new options are coming, and now some of them are going. Like, do you think things have settled down a little bit, or even if they haven't, like where are we right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think within mountain bike, things are definitely starting to streamline a bit. Hmm. You know, you look at things like in, say, the gravel segment or kind of like emerging segments between mountain bike and gravel. Like you're seeing like a lot of like larger gravel sizes now, which kind of almost starting to flirt with like a cross country size in many ways.
Yeah.
And you're starting to go from like, you're measuring from like the C size. Like, is that a 48C or a 47C, or is it a 2.0? Is it a 2.0 yet? Like, where, you know, and when you get to that 50 mark, you know, people start kind of calling it the inch size, you know. But
yeah. Is it good? It sounds like it's going the same direction kind of that mountain bike tires did for a while, right? Where it's just like, let's go wider until we reach the point where we're like, that's too wide. Is that kind of what's happening in gravel?
Dude, 100%. Yeah, man. I have this theory that in the bike biz, somebody will like acknowledge a trend, right? And then they'll say, oh, well, I want to do more of that and more because they think more is better.
Right.
And it worked sometimes it works to a point. And then they say, whoa, 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 that was too far. And they back off and they correct it.
Right.
And I think we saw that with, like, you know, 3.0 tires and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then they backed off and then they kind of have come back down to, like, you know, that somewhere between a 2.4, 2.6 kind of a sweet spot for a lot of trail bikes. Right. So, and, you know, the funniest part about this being a, someone kind of almost from the old school anyway, is that, dude, it all still starts with a two. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like 2.1, 2.8, like how many like tenths of an inch can you really slice and dice this thing and have like this whole revolution within an industry? It's hilarious to me. But, you know, if you put like a top racer on one or the other, I mean, yeah, sure. You know, races are won and lost in thousands of a second. I get that. But like, mm-hmm. you know, it's as far as like a fun factor and just going out and whatever, what I always say is ride what's fun, you know, like. I have a super crazy light XC hardtail. I have like an enduro bike and they're both fun for different reasons and they're way different. You know what I mean? So I don't think you're going to have like one universal solution. And I also do think, hitting back to what you said a second ago about the gravel scene emulating mountain biking, it's 100% that. If you go to a gravel race, you'll see people riding, you know, cyclocross tubulars. You'll see people riding, oh, fat bikes. I mean, like literally it's crazy. No, for real. Like if you go down to the Mid-South event, we've gone to that event the last few years. It used to be called Land Run. And that literally you'll see people on 29er hardtails. You'll see people running, you know, a traditional like 38C gravel tire. You see a lot of that, of course, but it's kind of like whatever's fun, you know, what should people ride? I mean, yeah, sure. Top of the bell curve for mountain bike right now, like I said, it's going to be anywhere between that 2.35 really to say 2.6. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might sound like a lot to some people, but you're really talking about not a lot of width difference there. And so depending on the tire tread and design and setup and your wheels and all that stuff,
right.
It's not vastly different in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, there are advantages.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's hard these days to, you know, you look at somebody's bike from a distance and, you know, people like to play the guessing game like, oh, what are those? 2.4s, 2.6? And I mean, you can't tell because it does have a lot to do with the rest of your setup, your rim width and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that's really been another big curveball lately, the last few years anyway, because, you know, ETRTO is actually changing. For people listening, ETRTO is basically a standardization within the industry that ensures that tires and rims fit properly together. And so within that, there are sort of like established design parameters where you'll basically say this width of a tire should go on this width of a rim, and it's within a range, you know what I mean? And so with all that said, I mean, if you put a 2.25 tire on a, you know, a 30 mil internal rim, it's probably going to measure more like a 2.35, mm-hmm. or maybe even a 2.4, depending on the tolerances, you know what I mean? So, and then what people do is then they go online and then, you know, they'll share their experiences, positive or otherwise. And, you know, some people get a little upset about it, but at the end of the day, it's like, dude, you put a tire on a wider rim, it's going to get wider.
Right. It's just math. It's just physics. Well, how important is tire weight to consumers right now? Do you see more riders that are willing to trade a little bit of extra weight for better traction?
Yeah. And traction and durability. I think that's absolutely something we're seeing. You know, a long time ago, it used to be like, how light can you make this? And then people started realizing that, well, if you're going to pinch flat the thing in 2 seconds, it doesn't really matter how light that is, because it's not going to be super fun, right?
Yeah.
Like, it comes back to just what's fun, right? So like, yeah, there's been a movement I've seen in the industry across really all categories where, I mean, even like World Cup XC guys, you know, they're running larger volume tires. So you have a bigger air cushion, but also then people are more willing to run tire liners or sidewall protection type tires or things of this nature. And it's all in the name of durability and then also traction, because you can run them, you know, at a slightly lower air pressure, so you have a better footprint. Whereas before, if you ran them at a lower air pressure, you were definitely going to pinch flat.
Right.
But now with a liner, especially with a liner and especially with the newer casings, you can get away with a little lower pressure a little better traction, especially if you're running a little bigger air volume.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned in that statement, even cross-country, you know, pro athletes, like they're the ones, if anybody is trying to save weight, it's them. And even they are seeing that it's okay to have a little extra weight if, as long as you get these additional benefits.
Yeah, I mean, the worst thing you can do is be one of those guys and train for years, right? And then you fly around the world to some race. I mean, the Olympics, right? Something like that, a future situation, and you get a flat because you wanted to save like 30 grams. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It all comes down to that sometimes, you know? And so, yeah, there's definitely a movement to do that. And the reason I bring up cross country is because, as you say, that is the spot where you think mm-hmm. that they would be the most crazy. Downhillers forever have just been about grip and durability, grip and durability. Don't get a flat. Make sure the tire hooks up.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in the reverse order. Make sure the tire hooks up first and then make sure you don't get a flat, right? But so, yeah, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So what are you seeing in terms of demand for 29er versus 27.5 diameters?
So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely been a movement for 29ers, obviously, across all categories. I mean, really, last year, you saw, you know, a lot of 29er downhill bikes and things like that. And I use that as an example because 29er is the same as 700C, which is a road size, mm-hmm. which is the predominant road size. And then that came over to cross country, and then it made its way through all the other categories, finally, you know, into that downhill scene. So that said, though, like, you know, I'm 5'9", you know, I'm like Joe average. I ride a 29er, but, you know, I do like the pop and the feel of 27.5. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who still ride 27.5, and especially people who are not tall enough to handle a 29er bike, or just like that, kind of like that big wagon wheel gyroscopic effect of like a bigger wheel where all that weight is further away from your hub. I mean, it really depends on what you're doing and what you're trying to accomplish. But I do think that we have seen more of a push into 29ers across really all categories. And I don't think that's like not cutting edge news or anything, but at the same time where you're going to see, you know, obviously 27.5s, I think still are people who want to run a little bit extra tire volume. So, you know, obviously that whole thing about how if you run like a roughly a 2.6 to 2.8 27.5 is roughly the same as like a 2.35 29er in terms of mm-hmm. outer circumference. So from frame clearance as well as like bottom bracket height on your bike, you know, they're kind of interchangeable around that kind of size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of mountain bikers obviously are hearing that 29ers are, I guess, more popular at the moment. You know, definitely more new bikes that are coming out seem to be 29ers. But then I think they're also wondering, like, is this just like a marketing push? Or is this for real? I mean, can you speak to that? Do you see that demand? Like,
sure.
Like we sell, you know, three times as many 29er as 27.5, or is it 50-50, or like where are we at right now?
I mean, I definitely think that there was 3 years ago, there was like obviously a huge spike in 27.5
mm-hmm.
And certain brands like full on stopped making 29ers and they went all 27.5 for a season or two, you know, and
yeah,
and then they're back doing 29er stuff now. But, you know, it's definitely noticeable accelerating on a 27.5. They're making the exact same with 27.5 versus 29er. It's like shifting a gear on your bike. I mean, like it's going to accelerate faster, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you hit big bumps and things like that, or just in terms of just like rolling, once it's up to speed, the 29er does seem to roll a little better. And, you know, I've had a lot of experiences with both, and my personal take on it is that I'm not terribly surprised to see those who can ride a 29er do so. But at the same time, like, you know, my wife, like she loves riding her 27.5 bike with like a 2.6 tire on it and just smacking stuff, you know, I mean, and again, it comes back to what's fun. So I do think there will be a place for 27.5 in the market. But I do think that, I mean, it's not even, I think, I mean, it's a fact, like 29er is like definitely across all categories now, you know, all my enduro buddies, like every single one of them, has basically switched back to 29er. So,
Yeah,
I mean, that's what I'm seeing anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I think think speaking to what people think is fun, I mean, it sounds like there will always be people that think that one is more fun or better suited for them than the other. And I mean, I guess people, they really want to know too, like, are these tires going to be available? And it sounds like you're saying they will, because there's demand for it.
Yeah, especially with like, you know, we support the kids racing leagues around the country. There's a number of them, NICA, and in New England, it's called NESCA. I mean, my daughter's 11 and she rides, you know, all the time. And she's not quite on a 27.5 wheel yet, but she will be, you know, before she rides a 29er, like as like new riders are coming up, and we've seen immense growth in the youth market, you know, in racing or otherwise, just participation wise. And, you know, so obviously, you know, as you're growing, you know, you'll hit a 27.5 before you hit a 29er, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's notable.
Yeah. Interesting. So walk us through like a really simple explanation of the anatomy of a mountain bike tire. Like, what are the key parts and like, how do they all kind of work together?
You know, some people actually even call it a carcass, but the casing is really like the kind of the framework that you build everything off of.
Okay.
And for the vast majority of mountain bike tires, that casing is going to be made out of nylon cloth. And it's going to be kind of measured in what's called TPI, which is threads per inch. So if you look at like really up close on a mountain bike casing, you'll actually see like threads. And TPI is just that. I mean, the more threads you can fit within an inch on a single layer, the thinner the threads are, which means that they're more flexible. And so that's why, like on the road market, you'll see like Vittoria makes cotton road tires for our, you know, pro level competition tires in the Corsa line. And the reason that we make those out of cotton instead of nylon for that level of racing is simply because they're super supple. So when you hit like a crack in the road or anything like that, they have less rolling resistance. So the same is true on a mountain bike tire. You'll see like tires from like a department store, and they have very low TPI. So very thick threads within that nylon casing.
Okay.
And, so like typically like on a race mountain bike tire, you're going to see something like 120 TPI is a very common thread count. And that's pretty much what we use through anything that's a tubeless ready Vittoria tire. So that's the first thing that they build off of. Then there's a big roller machine that kind of looks like a pasta maker almost. And they squish this material through it with rubber, and the rubber gets basically squished into the material. And that is the casing material. It's called a topping colander. So, once that's done, you can make it black, you can make it tan wall. You can do all sorts of crazy things with that. But a major important piece of the casing is then going to be the bead. So that bead used to just be, a steel wire. Now it's Aramid, which is commercially known as Kevlar, but basically, you know, the casing material gets wrapped around that. And, that's essentially what fits into the hook of your rim. The difference though, is that for a tubeless ready bead, it's a different shape. So if you're talking about like a traditional hook, rim, right? Not a hook, not this whole hookless thing. We're not going to get into that, but basically like a regular, like hooked rim where like you have, like you look at your rim and there's like a little like lip on it. Right.
Yeah.
If you were to like, look at that, like if you could like cut your rim and like look at the end of it, like in cross section, there's going to be like kind of like a square corner in there. And so, you know, tubeless ready beads have a much sharper bead, shape, that's much more square rather than that traditional teardrop shape that you would just get if you wrapped a piece of material around a wire.
Yeah.
And that's made to really lock in and hold the pressure and also create an airtight seal. So for that reason, beads have really become something that have really, I should say, evolved over like the last 10 years, especially. And then there's a bit of the bead called the chafer. And the chafer basically is sort of like what pads that and creates that positive seal. So on a higher quality tire, you'll see like a very defined line right above the bead on the tire. And it's basically made to do that, to create that really positive seal for tubeless use, as well as protection so that your rim doesn't cut into the tire. So that's kind of casing 101 in a nutshell. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
And then, so then you have the rubber that's, molded on top of the casing, I guess, for lack of a better word. It's all sort of like glued together.
Yeah.
Melted together. Vulcanized. Yeah, that's a good word.
Yep, it is. It sounds pretty dorky. But yeah, that's essentially what it's called. And so basically what happens is, like, for instance, if you're making like one of our 4C tires, like we have a 4C machine that has four separate sort of like, they look like injectors, essentially. They're like a big like nozzle, right? And the thing, basically the rubber gets fed into this big funnel and it gets squirt out, you know, this end piece that goes onto a conveyor belt. Mm-hmm. And the way that those four different types of rubbers, those four different types of compounds are basically laid down onto a flat conveyor belt. And then what they do is they'll actually cut a length of that and they'll wrap it around the casing and then they'll put it into the mold.
Okay.
This is a very simplified process right here, but I mean, it's much more complex, but basically, essentially that's what happens. And then it gets pressed up into the tread mold, which is obviously a negative of what the tread looks like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a few minutes later, they open the mold and out pops the tire. So in terms of the way the compounds work and how it's done, you know, there's obviously just thousands of different compound variations out there. We use compounds that are enhanced with graphene. Mm-hmm. And we're actually on our second generation of this. You know, people ask me about graphene a lot within compounds. The point of it, we'll just start there. The point was that we wanted to, again, take away any compromise. We wanted to make something that, as a performance tire, lasted longer than typical performance tires. We wanted to make it grippy, but yet still roll fast. Because oftentimes, if you make a tire too grippy, it's not going to roll fast, right? Things like this. So we did a ton of testing, and we actually came out with our second generation of graphene last year, graphene 2.0, mm-hmm. Where we were able to actually kind of functionalize, you know, and really pinpoint metrics that we were trying to kind of achieve within mm-hmm. different categories, right? Like, so like an enduro tire has to grip a lot better than, say, a tire that you're going to use for like city use, where city use is going to be much more about longevity or something like this, right? So there's different things you're trying to achieve here. The cool thing about that whole process has been that Vittoria was definitely a leader in this, which is really cool. We're seeing other companies kind of hop on now. Oakley made clothing with graphene in it, you know, for the heat dissipation properties and things like this. And you'll see tennis rackets and skis and things like this. But so many companies, they'll use terminology to describe their compounds, and it'll be a marketing term,
right?
You know, and they have to call it something. I get it. But like, people have asked me, dude, is this totally hype? Like, is this true? Like, what do you guys, what is, and the coolest thing is you literally can say, you can Google it. It's, we're not making this up. Like, yeah. we literally tell you what's in the compound. It's not like we're calling it something and then it's implied. It's like we call it a graphene compound because we put graphene in the compound. You know what I mean? Like, it's literally that simple.
Yeah, it makes it a lot harder to compare. I mean, we run into that all the time as journalists, right? You know, everybody's got their, you know, like you said, their marketing term for the thing that they're doing. But it's like, well, if everybody's doing something different, then you really can't, you can't compare.
Right. I mean, the default kind of answer is that we typically give is, you know, Popular Science wrote an article about our compounds. Popular Science doesn't care about bicycle marketing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like they're a science-based publication. Like, they wouldn't have wrote that article if it wasn't something notable about the science behind it. Right. So
yeah,
that was kind of a cool little milestone for us when that happened. But yeah, so compounds, really, at the end of the day, you want the tire to, like I said, you want it to grip and you want it to last as long as possible given the use, right? So much like tread design, which we'll get into in just a sec, but I mean, basically, like, you're designing a product around a specific terrain or use. So whether that terrain is pavement or dry, dusty trails or rocks or roots or whatever, mm-hmm. you have to kind of take all that into account. And so the compound is definitely a critical piece of that. as well as just the things that consumers expect when they buy something that is a premium product, right? If you're buying a premium XC tire, you're going to want that to roll fast. And so, you know, you have to make sure that that's one of the check marks that you design into it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then, you know, once you kind of have your casing and all that and the compound you want to use, it does come back to tread design. So fast is a funny thing. So what's fast in one place is not fast in another. And like, if you look at, say, a mud tire and you have like, you know, big spiky cleated knobs, well, that's designed to penetrate into the ground and then clean out on the next kind of rotation.
Yeah.
Whereas like, if you have like a hard pack tire, that's a surface phenomenon. Like, you're never actually digging into the terrain. You're trying to create surface area that then has grip as a result. It's like a basketball shoe in a basketball court. So, and then there's everything in between, right? Like, if you have like a mixed use tire, you have to have enough surface area for that kind of a situation, but you have to have enough room to clean, but then it still has to roll fast, because oftentimes if you have like a lot of voids on a tire, it's not going to roll as fast, things like that.
Yeah.
So it gets super duper techy. And what we've done at Vittoria, you know, having been like just a tread design dork since I was in high school, like, I mean, like literally try to create tread designs that have enough room to clean, but on the surface of like, say, each knob or each cleat, depending on like kind of what tire you're talking about, we put some sort of a texture like siping to, you know, maximize the grip given that small surface area. So as an example, like if you were to ride on like a muddy trail, yeah, great. Like, your tire is going to cut into that, but inevitably you're going to hit some rocks and roots or something elsewhere. And then your tire is not going to dig into a rock or a root. So you have to make sure that on top of that cleat, you have some siping, which is basically nothing more than like an engineered groove. And then it can grip on that surface as well. And then, you know, it's going to be a mixture of everything kind of all together. So I don't know. It was kind of like a lot. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, there's obviously a lot going on and a lot of thought goes into it. I mean, I think for a lot of people, you know, as consumers, you know, you maybe look at a tire in the store, the first thing that pops out to you is probably the tread pattern. You know, that's the thing that's like most obvious. But yeah, it's helpful to understand sort of how the compounds play into it, and also the sidewalls and the beads and everything, really. I mean, all of it, it's a complete package.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it has to work together as one package, right? So, and that's, it all comes back to getting feedback. Athlete feedback's critical. Having been like a tester athlete years ago, and I understand, like, I can appreciate, you know, what these testers are going through, and they're trying to make sure that they have, you know, a successful race or whatever. And then also like trying something like step by step, like incremental changes to see if we can make improvements on certain aspects. Oftentimes we have kind of product validation before we even launch the product. I mean, I know, like, for instance, you know, a Course of Speed is a road tire, and I know there's a mountain bike podcast, but I'll just say really quick, like on the Grand Tours, that won every single individual time trial. And it was like one of those things where I was like, wow, okay, that definitely works. You know, on the mountain bike side, I was standing at Interbike a week after we launched the Barzo XC tread in 2015 when it won world championships. Pauline won that race that year, just like she did this year. And unfortunately, she wasn't on our tires this year, but when she won her first mountain bike world championship, she was on the Barzo, and it was literally like weeks apart from the trade show. I mean, it was crazy. So that kind of a thing can happen, and it's kind of fun when it all comes together. And although it's, at the same time, it's not typically like a huge surprise, because the process is structured such that you have this validation before it gets launched. So it's never done until it's launched, right? So it's the kind of thing where like, it's not going to get launched unless it's to that level anyway.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the reason that, like, since really that moment, like our product line especially has been vastly different than it had been in the past.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, you're talking about like mud tires specifically, and then sort of contrasting that with a hard pack tire. So, you know, mountain bikers like to talk about owning a quiver of bikes to handle a variety of different conditions or trail types. What would a quiver of mountain bike tires look like? Could you put together, you know, like two or three sets of tires to do the job? Like, Does everybody need like one set of mud tires and one hard pack, or like, does that even make sense?
No, it totally does. I mean, the first thing is going to be based on where you live, right? I mean, if you're in Arizona, you're not going to really need mud tires a whole lot. But, you know, in New England, where I live, we have really four true seasons. Mm-hmm. And then oftentimes you have this weird thing where it overlaps. I mean, like quite literally yesterday it was 60 degrees and I was riding outside in shorts. And I know to somebody in Georgia, that might seem like it's still pretty cold. But anyway, I was like, hell yeah, it's warm. I'm going to wear shorts today. And then today, like it snowed. You literally have this temperature swing. And so you have to have a quiver, as you say, to as a mountain biker, to make sure that you're prepared for stuff. And, you know, I mean, it's not realistic to think that people are going to change their tires based on the weather. I mean, you'd be changing your tires every day, especially here. But I mean, you know, like seasonally, you'll have kind of something you ride in the spring, something you ride like most of the season, mm-hmm. and then something you ride probably in the winter months. And so like, just to kind of map out an example of that, like my setup is that I typically run like a larger volume, more aggressive tire all winter that can handle some snow and things like that, you know, and then I'll run in the springtime something that's going to clean really well because the trails are going to be a little sloppy and you have to respect all the trail work that gets done and all that stuff. Numba is always doing a lot of work up here. And obviously when they say that you can't ride, you're not supposed to ride, but all that said,
yeah,
inevitably you're going to hit a mud hole somewhere or something like that. And so you want something that's going to clean in the springtime. And then in the summer, I usually run something that's a touch more aggressive in front and something that rolls a touch faster in back. And that's usually my setup for most of the season. And so really three sets, you know, not to beat the gravel examples to death, but like in that product line, it's called Terreno. We have a dry, a mix, and a wet. Mm. And we did that for cyclocross people because cyclocross people were always asking, you know, what do I need? And it's like, well, in, you know, early season through like almost October, you need dries and you need mixes for like 3 weeks. And then you need wets for like November through January. And the reason I bring that up is because it was a really cool way to learn. Even after doing this for decades, I'm still learning, you know, and it's still the kind of thing where you say, you know, I never really thought about it that way before.
Yeah.
And maybe we can apply that same kind of methodology to other segments. And that's literally what we've done.
Yeah, that's really helpful because I think a lot of mountain bikers, I mean, we just want to ride, first of all.
Right.
And so, yeah, we don't always want to put a lot of thought into it. And, you know, if there's a tire that says this is an all-rounder, it's like, check, that's good. I can use it for everything. But like you're saying, you can get more out of a tire if it's suited for, you know, maybe just the season. I mean, it's not every single ride and it's not, you know, oh, I'm riding this trail versus that trail today. I need to change my tires. But yeah, maybe putting a little more thought into it than just go with the all around tire.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, that's really what it comes down to, you know, I mean, I think for a lot of people, if you broke it down into like, you know, thirds in terms of segments, you'd probably be pretty dialed and in most places anyway.
Yeah. So how do you know when it's time to replace a set of mountain bike tires?
So, you know, it's a tough question because some people like to get like, you know, completely like bare casing mileage out of their tire. And really what it comes down to is when you start feeling an appreciable difference when you're riding in the given situation that tire is designed for. So, you know, a second ago you were talking about an all-arounder and that checks a lot of boxes for people, but mm-hmm. oftentimes an all-arounder can be basically kind of okay at everything, but not really great at anything kind of a thing.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why we have so many different models so you can really pinpoint what you need. And then when you're pinpointing what you need, it's based on the terrain and your riding style and all that. So you're buying that tire for specific use. And then, so when you go out and you're using it in that specific use and it works for you and you're psyched for a while, eventually, you know, it's going to break down. I mean, it has to simply because otherwise it wouldn't be grippy enough to give you the performance you wanted in the first place. So, and despite all our efforts, you know, as designers, we still haven't solved that one. You know, eventually it will break down eventually. So when it does mm-hmm. and you feel it, you know, not giving you the exact same kind of performance you wanted when it was initially broken in, that's really the time when I change. But at the same time, you know, with 4C compounds and things like this. So 4C is like a layering process that we use where as I mentioned earlier, like there's four heads on that extruder, and the base of your tread has a firmer compound than the top kind of performance stickier compound. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is with that, the point of that is that the base of your tread is more stable, so it doesn't sort of like paperclip off, and you don't have that like wrinkling at the base of your knobs and all that stuff.
Yeah,
it lasts. In theory, it should wear like your car tires, where it wears, you know, from your tread down to your casing. Imagine if you're riding down the road in your car and your tread peeled off, like it'd be pretty bad, right? So my point in saying all this is that, you know, some people will on a 4C tire get to that other layer, and then they'll feel like where it's not as sticky across rocks and roots or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But yet there's still enough tread on it to ride it. And that's where you have to make the judgment call and say, okay, like if I live in a dry terrain area, it's not going to be as big of a deal. But if you're like riding in British Columbia or New England, you're definitely going to notice it more when you get past that like halfway mark.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I mean, I think it is hard. It's hard for me, and I'm sure others as well, because it is so gradual. You know, it's like every ride, a little more is getting worn off, a little more, and you kind of just get used to it, right? Like as it wears, you know, it's not like all of a sudden you're like, whoa, what just happened to my tire? And, you know, I think too, people are used to like car tires where, what is it? You put the penny in, and if you can see Abe Lincoln's head or something, like you're okay or you're not okay. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I guess visually too, you could maybe inspect your tire and kind of get an idea of like where you're at in terms of the wear.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You'll see that siping starting to kind of wear first because it's at the surface. And that's definitely something. But as you mentioned, it's a gradual wear. And so like as you ride, you're comfortable with your bike and it's not really that big of a deal. But then the day comes where you throw a new set on and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, right. You can tell that for sure.
You know what I mean? And so that's definitely something where it's an immediate improvement, which is cool.
Yeah. So one of the things that it seems like people are using a lot more these days and are getting excited about for some weird reason is mountain bike tire plugs. As far as I know, Vittoria doesn't offer any of those yet. So are there solutions on the market that you would recommend that like you found work really well?
You know, you're right. We don't offer them yet. We definitely played around with a lot of things and we're constantly evolving our product line. And I'll just leave it at that. But the ones that I've found to work the best, I mean, are just like, you know, those little like bacon strip looking things that you can pretty much get at almost any auto parts store just because they're really, really sticky, gummy, you know, and they'll fit really well, and they're easy to you know, apply, and they don't really care about sealant as far as like being sticky still. So that's been something that's worked for me personally. But yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of different ones on the market. At the end of the day, we're really trying to and I don't know that this is a problem you can ever truly solve, but any way we can create a tire casing that is less susceptible to that in the first place, you know, it's definitely something that we chase. So, you know, the way we do the chafer on the bead, the sidewall protection, all that stuff, in the event that you still do get a puncture, if you're not running a liner or something like that, I mean, even when you're running a liner, sometimes the rock is just so sharp that it doesn't even take your tire to be compressed for it to get cut sometimes, you know, and that's where one of these plugs is definitely valuable. I think it's cool that people have started using them in mountain bike. But yeah, no, as of right now, we don't make one.
Yeah. Speaking of that, though, I mean, I guess tire plugs, too, are kind of addressing the problem with sealants, right? That, I don't know, when sealant first came out, tubeless tires, you know, there were these demonstrations of people just like hacking huge holes into the tires and somehow sealant would seal it up. But that obviously doesn't work every time. And so people have had to do these tire plug solutions, but Vittoria does have a tire sealant. So what kind of makes yours different with, you know, all the choices that are on the market? Like where is there room for innovation, I guess?
Yeah, no, it's an awesome question. It's something that actually I get asked a fair bit. So, you know, within tubeless tires, really in bicycle anyway, it started in mountain bike and then it's obviously made its way over to road. And the reason I mention that is because there's really two things that are going to be like key kind of metrics with this, which is basically going to be like, how fast can it find the hole? Mm-hmm. And then how big of a hole can it fill? Right. So For instance, you can make your sealant super thick and it would clog a big hole, but it wouldn't find the hole very fast. And likewise, you could make the thing find the hole really fast, but then it just all leaks out of the hole. You know what I mean? So I mean, you know, there's the ideal balance is somewhere in between. It's something that our sealant seems to do pretty well at. And it's also thin enough to use on like smaller volume tires, but it's also like effective enough on bigger volume tires, which is to say you can ride it in road or mountain and use it in both. And that's been good. But yeah, I mean, it's the other thing is just going to be like longevity with the sealant, because you really need to kind of like recharge your sealant like about every 6 months or so.
Yeah.
And the reason is because, you know, hey, I mean, when the sealant finds the hole in your tire, it's going to hit the air and it's going to evaporate a bit and cause that seal. So your tire is inherently porous. And so over time, it's going to kind of, you know, leach out a bit just through your casing without you even really knowing. And so it's definitely something that's just good practice to kind of top up your sealant every once in a while, unless you're changing your tires for the season, like we spoke about before. But yeah, I mean, if I was going to say one thing about the Vittoria sealant, it is a good balance between finding the hole and then sealing the hole.
Yeah, that's great. I've never heard it sort of put that way, but you know, I think as consumers, we focus on like, I want something that's going to just seal the hole, but we don't think about, we need something that's going to get to the hole quickly. And yeah, that is a trade-off that obviously is challenging.
Yeah. I mean, just to add to that, I mean, like I've tested everything on the market, you know, I mean, that's part of my job is to test everybody else's stuff. And so often, you know, you'll be on a trail and somebody will be, you know, sitting on the side of the trail with a cartridge or a mini pump or something, trying to pump up their tire. And it's a perfect case of the hole was too big to seal really quick and the sealant couldn't get there fast enough. Mm-hmm. And then eventually it kind of sealed and they got like 5 PSI in the tire. And the guy, right. and the guy's like, I'm good. And he keeps pumping it up. And then like that little scab of sealant pops off. So you got to wait again. Right. It's the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, so, you know, it happens, but that's part of sealant testing.
Yeah, definitely. So with mountain bikers preferring to run lower and lower tire pressures these days, how has that influenced tire design?
First of all, if you design it to be a touch more square, it's going to deal with that lower pressure a bit better because you're already designing the contact patch to be in more contact with the ground in the first place. Mm-hmm. But the other thing it does is when you lean over, if you're on like a super round profile tire and you lean over on it, you know, as you lean over, all that force like increases, right? So like you're asking the tire to kind of overcome like a bigger kind of obstacle to kind of grab and hold onto the ground, especially if you like really lean over fast and then that's when you kind of understeer, right? So if you have a bit more of a square profile, those side knobs engage earlier in the lean and they can kind of grab on and then hold on as you lean versus being kind of surprised at the last second when you lean all the way over on around a profile. So the profiles, I would say, are the biggest thing. But then the other thing is there's been with all this evolution, especially in the last 5 years or so, you're seeing a lot of tires in the market where like the side knobs will just rip right off. And so it's really made designers kind of like address that and make sure that you either put like more support outside of that side tread or like what we've done, like I said, with the 4C before, with the layering of the compound so that you have like a firmer base compound, which is much more stable. But then also we've done some things where like I use what's called, I call it progressive sipe width. And the idea is that a bigger sipe flexes more than a smaller sipe. So like, for instance, if you look at like the side knob of like our Martello, you'll see that on the inside effective edge of that side knob, like the edge that does all the work on your side knob, right? The inside edge, there's like a big sipe first, and then the sipes get progressively smaller. So when that knob compresses, like sort of like an accordion, mm-hmm. it's really gummy on that inside edge, but it's really much more edge. So instead of flopping over, it literally compresses. And it's something that gives you a much more controlled feel, much more progressive feel, but it also lengthens the useful life of your tire because it, you know, the wear characteristics are going to be very different at that point, but it still gives you all the performance benefits. So that's one way as an example of how tires have designs have evolved with lower air pressure use in mind, because before it like wasn't even a thing. You know what I mean? It was like,
right.
It was just like an even tread depth, and it was a rounder profile, and that was kind of it.
Yeah. Well, it seems like one of the solutions or things that people have done to compensate for air pressures is these new tire inserts. And Vittoria seems like was a fairly early mover in this category. So what are the advantages of running tire inserts in your mind? I mean, we've been given that there are a lot of them, but like, what's kind of the primary to you?
From a feel and performance standpoint, there's still an air pocket that's a tunable air pocket, like between the liner and the underside of your tread there. So your tire can still move around and conform to the terrain, which is critical for traction. If you had a very rigid tire casing, your traction would be horrible because the tire couldn't then conform to the terrain, right? So that's part of the reason that there's air in tires is for cushion, but it's also for that traction. So anyway, all that said, yeah, liners allow you to have a tunable air pocket, so you still maintain that traction. But when you bottom it out, it feels like a volume spacer in your fork or something, mm-hmm. where you can't. There's none of that like harsh twang like when you smack your rim. It's literally like a thump, and people have like a breakthrough like the first time I feel like they ride liners, and you know, because they go through this mental thing where they're like, I don't want to add weight, I don't want to pay the money for it, all that stuff, and then they try it and they're like, oh my god, like how did I ride without this? You know, particularly in the back wheel. And I run one on every single bike I have, and not because I work for Vittoria, because like honestly, like especially I'll say this, I said it earlier, but on the XT crowd, like you think that they would be crazy weight conscious and they wouldn't use it. All of the top XC World Cup guys are using liners, whether they tell you or not. Often Flixer will sponsor, but they're all running them. And the thing about it is, it matters more the lighter your bike is, because it's less of a proportion of the overall weight if you're worried about the weight piece. But take the weight out of it. On an XC bike, your tires and your wheels are lighter and skinnier. And so you have less to actually take that impact. So it's actually more critical in that scenario to run a liner. So I think liners typically came in and they were like a downhiller enduro guy thing. And they absolutely still are. But at the same time, I think it's actually most critical in XC, especially because XC courses have gotten pretty gnarly lately too. There's like a,
yeah, for sure.
The top ones have like, I mean, you know, racing downhill like in the 90s, it's like a lot of the XC courses now are like harder than the downhill courses were back then.
Yeah, definitely. So what kind of sets the Vittoria airliner apart from the other tire inserts that are on the market? It's got like a definitely, I mean, they're all different. And yeah, I think people are curious to know like what kind of design decisions went into it and like why they are the way that they are.
Sure. Yeah. So the Vittoria airliner is unique for a couple of reasons. So first of all, we have four different sizes, and the sizes are actually widths. So small, medium, large, extra large, mm-hmm. which handles basically from an XC tire all the way up to like almost like a fat bike, really like a large plus size tire and beyond. And so they come in a length. And what you do is you wrap it around your wheel, you cut it, you zip tie it, you put our decal around it to kind of make sure that seam stays aligned. And so basically first of all, with that step, some people are like, is that cheesy to do that? But honestly, that step allows you to, first of all, make sure that it fits super tight on whatever rim you have. Mm-hmm. But second of all, it allows you to tune how it interacts with the bead of your tire. So for instance, if you're running, because rim widths are all over the place right now. So if you're running like a traditional XC wheel, you might have like a 23 internal. I mean, like that's really these days really narrow, but 2 years ago, like that was pretty normal for XC wheels. You know what
yeah.
I mean? So
yeah.
And, or you might have like a 35 internal, like, or anything between for most bikes. Right. So, you know, if we were to make it just sort of like a hoop, it would fit different on different rims. So we wanted to make sure that you could like you, the rider could then really make things damn tight on your wheel. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that for shops and stuff like that, cause we want to make sure that shops are able to then, you know, service these things too. They don't have a gajillion SKUs. They have like four SKUs, which is a good thing. But the big reason why ours is different is that you have full compatibility with any valve on the market. So there's a sort of a groove on the top and a groove on the bottom. And the groove on the bottom allows you to run any valve you already have in your wheel. You don't have to run our special valve.
Right.
You don't have to try to find the valve hole while you're installing the thing, and it's a big pain. It's not like that. So, and then the groove on the top, it gives you more volume for that tunable air pocket. But the cool thing is, on either side of that groove, sort of like the edge of the groove comes to a point. And so when you compress that, that point then gets wider as you compress more material. So it compresses progressively. So basically, like, it's not just like a wham, I can really feel it, that's where it engaged and whatever. It actually kind of feels very much more progressive because of that. And which is great. It feels much more intuitive that way. Mm-hmm. And kind of works through the suspension well. One little thing that I typically do is, if you're on the edge tire size wise, I usually size down one. So like, you know, if you're running, say, a 2.35 tire, you could run a medium and it would definitely fit in there.
Yeah.
Or you could run a small, and which is more for an XC tire. I personally like how that feels better because it gives you a bit more air pocket, and the air pocket itself is going to ramp up as it gets compressed. And then by the time it hits the liner, it feels a bit more intuitive. You still have the protection. It's a little lighter. So yeah, if you're going to err on one side or the other, I would just always go one side smaller if you're on the edge.
Yeah, interesting. So you worked for Maxxis actually at the time that the Minion was being developed. Tell us about your involvement in the launch of that, you know, now iconic tread pattern. I mean, I think a lot of people are fans of that tire. And
yeah. So yeah. God, where to be? All right. So, so I, like I said earlier, I was lucky enough to be hired by Maxxis a long time ago. And, you know, I spent 10 years there. And, you know, honest to God, when I left Maxxis, we had accomplished a lot of things. And I was thinking about doing my own tire brand. And I knew that Vittoria had a good quality control in their factory, as well as produced tires for, Vittoria produces tires for a lot of other companies that I'm not going to name. But, and so I actually went there to do my own tire brand because I wanted to kind of take what I had kind of learned working with all the athletes at Maxxis and kind of bring it over here. But all that said, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people who I met in this scene, I met when I was working at Maxxis, obviously. And so, yeah, to speak to that really quick, I mean, it was a special time. The Minion itself was the very first tire design I was involved with. I have the original mold drawing for the Minion, and I have my contract still from that era, which kind of details everything I went through. But I mean, you know, with every project, you have an athlete that you deal with and that you kind of design tires with. And I have a whole roster of athletes in Vittoria I do this with as well. The athlete that I worked with on the Minion project was Colin Bailey.
Okay.
So he was a top US racer at the time, and he's a mechanic in the industry now. But, and basically Russell Webb was like, hey, you and Colin go figure out like a new downhill tire. And so I was like, all right, cool. So Colin had like some initial sketches of the Minion, and it was sort of like, we were sitting in West Virginia at a hotel room, I remember. And I remember taking his drawing and saying, it's kind of like upside down and backwards almost. Like, I remember taking it and looking through the drawing at the light,
yeah,
and saying, if you could imagine it projected this other way, you'd have pockets for all these kind of like directions to kind of pack dirt into and things like that. So, you know, Colin definitely had a vision. I don't mean to speak for him at all. Total respect.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, it was my job as the product guy then to take an idea from an athlete and translate it into a product. And that was my involvement with the Minion. So I was able to speak his language as a rider, you know, albeit he was a better rider than me. You know, I still had a license. I was still there. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I was able to speak his language and then also speak the production language and say, okay, like, the tread needs to do this, this, and this across these terrains. And I remember his design was very moto inspired, and it didn't have that trademark center kind of swoopy sipe in there that you see. And so that was something that I added that night in that hotel room. And then those like L-shaped knobs were actually backwards originally. And so we did that. And then dimensionally, it wasn't like there was perhaps a bit too much space. So we kind of rescaled everything and basically put it all back together. And I would confidently say that, you know, the first Minion mold drawing has my signature and Colin's signature on it.
That's cool.
For that reason. And you know, I'm not trying to be like, you know, I did this in a bubble by myself. It's not like that at all. Colin had, he had the original, like we need to do something that addresses this. And then I basically took his thought process and put the finishing touches on it as far as how it actually can accomplish those things. So yeah, I mean, without that, it probably would have looked a lot like just more of like a moto block tire that didn't have all that nuance that the Minion has, like that, like I said, that curve siping, the ramping, the all that other siping on the side knob and all that stuff. So, and I mean, and yeah, for what it's worth, I mean, you know, I use that as a platform to then do like a lot of the other tires when I was at Maxxis, and then everything else that I learned from and applied at Vittoria. So, that was, I believe, the only tire that Colin was involved with, but I was lucky enough to kind of go on and design dozens and dozens more from there. I'm always thankful for that time, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's really cool to hear that and to understand like where these tire designs come from. And, you know, I'm sure you've played that process out many, many times since then. And some tires are more successful than others. I mean, what's the difference then? Is luck part of it? Like are you just, you know, I mean, like every time you're working just as hard and you're like, yeah, you know, this, we're following the same process and we're working with athletes, you know, athletes who may even be more talented or less talented or whatever, but still following that, you know, recipe, but some are just going to work better than others. Right.
I mean, yeah. And you know, some of it is, you know, art and science being put together. Right. I mean, and some of it is being at the right place at the right time and having that tire launch at a time where there aren't competitors that have addressed that same thing.
Yeah.
You know, to put this in a framework just for your listeners, I mean, like that, dude, that was 2001.
Yeah. And it's still going strong. It's not, you know, it still works, right? Like,
I mean, it does. Yeah. I mean, and the reason is because we put a whole lot of thought into it and, you know, I mean, and absolutely a lot of testing. And I would say that was the tire that really put Maxxis on the map. I mean, you know, and it was the kind of thing where like there was some XC tires that Steve Larson had done before that and some other things. But as far as like, in the gravity segment at that time, I mean, this is pre-social media. This is mostly pre-e-commerce.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, bike shops were trying it out and OEMs were trying it out. And you know, it leveraged a lot of those things to kind of get some market share for them and, you know, have them grow to kind of what they've become in that way. And so, I mean, full respect for Dr. Chung and everybody at the tech center, you know, there, I mean, you can't say they don't make a good product, but I will say that it's almost 20 years ago. And if you look at the bikes, I mean, legit, like the bikes that we were putting that on had like, you know, downhill bikes had like 70 degree head angles and like six inches of travel and, you know, like, you know, 680 bars and stuff. And like, so, I mean, it's time. It's time to evolve. And, you know, like I said, I mean, I've taken a lot of those lessons and sprinkled them through tires like, you know, Martello or Moda or other tires that I've done for Vittoria. This new Agaro tire towards this past year in the trail category, it has a lot of the things that I learned along the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would just say watch this space because we have something coming that really is going to be a really obvious evolution of everything I've learned. And I think it's going to make a splash this summer. So stay on the lookout for that.
Cool. Yeah, that's exciting. I'm looking forward to that. So where are you looking for this like next wave of tire performance gains? Are there parts of the system that still have room for improvement? I mean, is it tread? Is it compound, you know, or is it just a combination of all that?
Yeah, I mean, people have really split that hair a lot recently, especially. And so now it's really about improving quality and continually just trying to improve one aspect without sacrificing another. You know, and that's really the game. Like I said, it's not hard to make something that hooks up, but it'll probably be heavy and it'll probably roll slow. You know, it's not hard to make something that rolls fast, but it probably won't have traction. You know what I mean? Like, so it's really a matter of designing one element without sacrificing another element, and how that all gets applied. So, yeah, I mean, it's that evolution and just riding more and talking to people and, you know, just getting out in front of it and then dealing with athletes who operate at a level that may be like a click or two above most people. And if it's proven there, then, you know, the, you know, weekend warriors will be really psyched.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really awesome. Well, Ken, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us and really explain tires and also talk about sort of where the trends are heading these days. Really appreciate it.
Man, anytime. I could talk about tires for days. So anytime, man, you know me. But anyway, dude, I love what you do. Thank you for doing what you do in the industry. And thank you for the opportunity to be on today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You can learn more about some of the products we talked about at vittoria.com and be sure to follow the Singletracks podcast. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.